From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Jeannie Yandel. 23 people in Redmond, Washington shared the world record for firewalking in 1997. The coals reached over 1,800 degrees. And when Jeff Davis investigated the story, he decided he wanted to build his own ultra-hot firewalk. Jeff is co-author of the book Weird Washington, and it's part of his job to track down strange and unexplained phenomena all over the state. And the firewalk was one of his first assignments. So, Jeff, what happened when you decided to build your own firewalk?
Well, it's an interesting story at the beginning because I tried contacting these people, any of them, to can I at least come up and watch you do the firewalk? And oddly enough, I couldn't relocate them. You know, the internet, you can have these ghost websites where people appear and disappear. And my publisher was saying, Jeff, deadline. You need to get this done. We need some photos. So it was just a matter of me saying, okay, I've got a deadline. It's amazing those little bits of pressure that will come down and make us do something like that. So we did do that. It was just me solo walking this first time. I've actually done three of them. And I had some old wood at the house with no nails in it. And we just built a fire. And it actually took several hours to do because the fire, you know, the fire is quite large. And I raked it out into a bed of coals about 10 feet long. And it's not a natural act. If anyone does this, it is unnatural. So there are people who believe, on one hand, it is mind over matter. It's a spiritual thing. God will protect you, or magic, or chanting and meditation. On the other hand, if I may play Tevia, no, it's all a matter of physics. There are all these, you know, transthermal, dermal transformation of heat into the air, not on the people's feet, and that's why you don't get burned. Well, when I was standing there trying to center myself, I was counting on both things to protect me.
You were hedging your bets.
That's right. Let me meditate. Let me also hope that the Professor Leidenfrost, who said that I won't get burned, was right as well. And actually, it only took me about 2 minutes, once I really decided to do it, of just concentrating, to actually start across. And it is a matter of concentration. Because it's not natural, it does hurt, but you try and remove yourself from that, but you've got millions of years of evolution telling you this is hot, don't do it.
Yeah.
And probably, I think, my second step onto the coals, the bed of coals were actually raked over what had been a rodent burrow. So on my second step, my foot went right down into a rodent burrow, sank down about to my ankle, and that did break my concentration. And so everybody watching me said, Jeff, it was like a fraction of a second. You sort of hesitated, but you kept on going. What happened? And to me, subjectively, it was like an hour when I was saying, okay, if I try and jump and scream, what's going to happen is I'm just going to get my foot jammed even further Or if I try and go left or right or run, the next step, my foot's going to be jammed down into it. So let me just go.
Oh my gosh.
And so I just kept on going.
I should say that, Jeff, as you're describing this, particularly your foot sinking into that rodent hole, my mouth is hanging open. I know I look horrified. I can feel my face crinkling up. So you got to the end of the firewalk, and you said that you've done it three times now.
Yes.
Why have you done this again?
A lot of my friends and relatives said, this is so great. You know, you talk about it was uplifting. Let's try, you know, do another one, and we'll see if anybody else will walk. And I actually, at the third one, we had about a dozen people there kind of cheering me on and not chanting, but, you know, like, yeah, yeah. And then I went across, and I was followed by kind of my nephew, who did it with me before. It's kind of a macho thing. And I said, okay, who's next? Absolute silence. And so we just barbecued on what was left of the coals after that.
Jeff, you said that you had told family members that this was uplifting.
Yes.
What was uplifting about the firewalk? What did you get from doing this firewalk?
Well, it's a whole bunch of different levels, because there's always this measure of, am I brave? This question everybody has, male or female, young or old, am I brave? You know, if an opportunity happened, if I was in my house and an armed robber came in and tried to hurt my family, what would I do? And this is along those same lines. Am I brave enough to do what I've seen people do, you know, in movies countless times? They know it's a special effect in movies. But on one level, I think everybody would like to do it is not just a matter of how brave they are or how much pain they can endure. It's an act of faith. Like I was saying, I was trusting in physics and I was trusting in mind over matter both at the same time. And so when you do something that you know is difficult, that every fiber of your being says you shouldn't do this, but you do it anyway, it is uplifting that way. You know, it is an act of faith.
I'm talking with Jeff Davis. He's the co-author of the book Weird Washington, and we're talking about some of the things that he's done and experienced as a result of working on this book. Well, Jeff, one of the things that I know you also did was you went and investigated something called a gravity hill. I know what a gravity hill is. It was something that we would tell stories about when I was a little kid. But for listeners who don't know what a gravity hill is, what's a gravity hill?
Well, a gravity hill, just about every state in the union has a gravity hill, and it is like the stuff of urban legend. And one of the urban legends is, and this goes back to Texas, where there was a school bus trapped on some railroad tracks, and the train hit the bus and killed several of the children. And the tracks are kind of at the bottom of a hill, and if you park on that bottom of the hill and put your car in neutral, the car will move uphill over the tracks safely. And that's one story. And then they have the fingerprints of children, you know, on the back of the car. There are other people, these gravity hills, they think are places where there's a lot of iron ore in the hills and it's all magnetized. And so that will actually attract the metal of a car, which of course, with our modern cars being mostly plastic, that doesn't make sense. But, and there are other people who treat them very seriously because, you know, it's kind of anticlimactic, but yeah, I found Gravity Hill. And they say, well, what it is it's just an optical illusion. Even though it looks like the road is going uphill, it's actually going downhill.
Well, you went to the one of the gravity hills in mm-hmm. Washington State. It's near Prosser, Washington, and I know we're not supposed to divulge the exact location.
Yeah, that's what makes it worthwhile to find it.
We don't want to make it easy for people. But you even brought a GPS with you to sort of see what would happen.
Yes.
What happened?
Well, it was kind of interesting because somebody, you know, for those people who do try and find it, somebody has spray-painted start on the road. And approximately 0.15 miles, you know, one-tenth and plus a fifth of a mile long, is this kind of course. And you can see at the end of this 0.15 miles, there is a little hillock. The road actually does come up very visible, very definite. Probably in about 100 feet of road space or 50 feet of road space, the road rises up 3 or 4 feet. And when I went out there, I looked at the road. And then because I try and be aware of angles, you know, there are all these like Knott's Berry Farm kind of optical illusion houses and like off the road a little bit on either side. I said, gosh, it looks uphill to me. And so I was there with a witness companion and we had a GPS unit and I left the car engine running, but I put it neutral, let off on the brake. And we reached about 15 miles an hour, I think, or 12 to 15 miles an hour. And, you know, in a tenth of a mile, you would have to be going down a pretty steep grade to get that fast.
Yeah.
And, you know, as we started going further up the hill, our speed slowed down, but we still crested it. We didn't stop. We actually crested it about 5 miles an hour.
Wait, are you saying that you went went uphill at 12 to 15 miles an hour?
Yeah,
just want to make sure that's what you're saying.
Yes. You know, toward the top of the hill in that last 100 feet or so where the road got really steep, you know, we slowed down. Down to about 5 miles an hour, but we still crested this little hillock at 5 miles an hour. And I brought a GPS unit with me. And it is, you know, of course, there's a couple seconds delay as it, you know, fixes your position. But I'm pretty certain that the elevation did go up and up and up the entire time we went up that hillock. And even more interesting, you know, we crested the hill, went down the other side, and carried on for a little while. And I turned around and drove back to the crest of that hill. And as we were heading downhill toward the start line, I stopped the car, put it in neutral, left off on the brake, and we actually stayed at a mile grade facing downhill, and we didn't move.
What? I should be asking you an actual question, but what did you think when this was happening?
I thought, this is really cool. It's one of these things where this is the curiosity where I think, you know, for me, writing this book, researching and writing this book, you know, was part of that. And I think this is what interests people when they read a book like this is this real or is it not? And I went out a couple more times, and I, you know, testing the iron theory. I brought a cannonball and I brought a rubber ball, and I like dropped both. I tried to play Galileo, and I found what happened is the road was actually curved in such a way that both balls rolled sideways onto the shoulder. So it is really interesting. I took pictures from different angles, and again, it still looks, even though I'm very clear, you know, it undulated, it went up and down a little bit. I didn't think that it was enough of a slope to accelerate so quickly before heading uphill. I'd like to go back out actually with the surveyor's transit, because I did archaeology work for a number of years, and it is really easy to have your eye fooled by angles. So that's kind of my little caveat in this, is it's not been proven, but it's just bizarre.
Well, it seems like you've been convinced enough to want to go back out there with more instruments to continue to analyze the why of this.
Yes, yes.
And aside from that, aside from sort of having this experience of being convinced enough to want to investigate further, what did you take away from that?
I think, and I'm probably going to get the quote wrong, a philosopher once said, the trick of seeing new things is not going to new places. It's seeing things with new eyes. And really, that's what I've taken out of this is, you know, people talk to me and ask me variations of questions. You know, like, you know, you did this whole thing, and now I'm writing Weird Oregon. You know, how has it changed you? And, you know, what... It's so amazing. You can walk down a lot of places in Seattle and see things you just walk right by. And if now I'm trying to like point them out, so see this with new eyes. You visit some of these places not knowing what to expect. Sometimes you are changed. Other times you just leave. Well, that was pretty cool.
I'm talking with Jeff Davis. He's the co-author of a book called Weird Washington. And he's telling me some of the sort of standout stories for him of things that he experienced while investigating for this book and writing this book. And the third place that I want to go with you is, it's on the San Juan Islands, and it's a family mausoleum.
Yes. The McMillan family, starting in the late 1800s, early 1900s, were smart enough and fortunate enough and had just enough wealth to actually set up a lime works, which produced quicklime for cement. And when the deposits were still there, when there was enough to keep the place running, you know, it was just one of these wonderful factory towns where they still paid people in company scrip at the company store, because they actually had to bring everything to San Juan Island. You know, they had this huge workforce, and if they tried, you know, buying stuff at a store, the storekeeper would, you know, pass on the expense of bringing stuff out by ferry. So they paid in scrip almost to the last day that they were in operation. And yes, it was a profitable venture for them. They actually built a place called the Hotel de Haro, which still exists, for guests who were big customers would come out and see the lime works, and the remains of the coke oven, the lime ovens, excuse me, are still there. But the McMillan family, I don't know how many generations they survived after the original Mr. McMillan, but at least himself, his wife, in his first generation, when they died, they actually built this open-air mausoleum that's called Afterglow Vista. And it was maybe a 20-minute walk from the wharfs, from the Hotel de Haro, which, of course, he built. And it really was, even if you're not religious, walking there, it was January or December when I went out there, and there was just a little bit of snow on the ground and snow on the trees, and it was approaching sunset when I finally hit the mausoleum. And there was a wrought iron gate, and walking through the gate, McMillan was a Freemason, and so he used a lot of symbology. And when I say mausoleum, this is not some kind of house built halfway underground where you like walk down three steps and open a door, you know, and there are like niches. What this is a replica of a Greek temple, one of these kind of round top temple, not like the Parthenon, but some smaller types, and it's got a series of columns on this large pedestal, and in the center of this pedestal, there is this large stone and concrete dining room table. It's a replica of their family table, and there are chairs behind each of, you know, behind the table, one for each family member, and their names and their birth and death dates are all on these chairs, because when they died, they were cremated, and their ashes were put in the pedestals of these chairs. And it's just rife with symbology, because when they built this temple, they purposely built it with one of the columns is actually broken and on the ground nearby. And that's to symbolize that's to symbolize a futility of pride and too much effort, you know, personal ambition and arrogance. And there are a series of steps, 3, 5, and 7, which have symbology from ancient Greek and Masonic times. And so it's just really interesting because, again, I was the only one out there. I was the only guest in the hotel that night, too. So everybody on the island was like a local person, and here I am. I had to walk through a cemetery to even get here. And it was just, it was moving.
Why was it so moving for you?
Well, you know, McMillan was the wealthiest man on the island and probably one of the wealthier men in the Puget Sound. And even though this was like a monument and, you know, took all of his money to build it, at the same time, he still wanted to portray something as more than just myself. It, to me, along some lines, is, look, I'm the most powerful man on this island and look what I can afford to build. But this is bigger than me. I'm memorializing my family. I'm memorializing this whole ethos of, you know, no, to use the phrase, no man is an island. It really was kind of touching in that way.
Well, Jeff, what do you think that you've learned personally from having the experiences that you've had investigating this book and writing this book?
I've learned a lot of patience, for one thing. In particular, you know, everybody's got something that bothers them, that gets to them, you know, whether it be family members or politics or who knows what. But with me, I guess it's traffic is one thing. I didn't have a lot of patience with traffic. You know, maybe it's a typical guy. Why ask for directions when I can drive around in a circle looking for a landmark? And so just a part of this has been a lot of patience, particularly after firewalking. You know, when you feel fulfilled on a certain level, you don't sweat the small stuff anymore, I guess. It perspectivized, if that is a verb. Put things in perspective for me. Yeah, you know, I'm stuck in traffic. Yeah, I'm going to be a couple minutes late. It used to be always on time, on time, on time. And now that's not quite so important anymore. It's a personal journey, I guess. But it's also, you know, being a little more laid back about things, more easygoing. You know, what do you have to prove at a certain point? That's why you see these multimillionaires wearing tweed jackets and tennis shoes to business meetings, and all their underlings are wearing three-piece suits. What do I have to prove?
That's a good perspective to have, Jeff.
Most of the time I have it. Sometimes, every once in a while I lose it, but not all that often anymore.
Well, Jeff, thank you so much for coming in and talking with me. I really appreciate it.
I appreciate being here. This has been fun.
Jeff Davis is the co-author of Weird Washington. It's a book that explores some of the unexplained phenomena in Washington State. There are a lot more than you think. You can learn more at KUOW.org. Search for Weird or Washington. Jeremy Richards produced this interview. From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Jeannie Yandel. Monday, June 23rd, 2008.